I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Mindfulness meditation has really made its way into the very fabric of Western culture. Today, we have with us Jon Kabat-Zinn. He's widely considered the father of mindfulness in this country. Later on, we'll be speaking with Dr. Kristen Neff. She's a pioneer in the research and practice of self-compassion. Our number is 888-477-9499. 888-477-9499. I have a sneaking feeling we're going to be backed up with callers, so please call early in the show. So, Jon, welcome to the show.
Hi there, Dan. It's really nice to connect with you again.
Yeah.
It's been too long.
It has been too long.
And it's also a wonderful occasion, I must say. I'm really honored to be part of your next to the last show.
Yeah, well,
series at least.
Yeah, it's next to the last of the weekly show. We're going to be having specials, and who knows?
I'm well aware of that.
We could figure out a way to connect there too. Jon, I want to talk to you about something that is happening right now, and it's something that has kind of turned the world upside down. That's of course the terrorist attacks in Paris. I want to understand how and why meditation works, of course, but I also want to take a macro view of this and see how mindfulness meditation might apply to the world stage.
Yeah, well, it's a favorite subject of mine, so I appreciate your opening with that, and especially, you know, in the aftermath of what just unfolded in Paris. And, you know, I think we all see what the consequences are of a certain way of moving forward in the world, where, you know, we're creating, you know, just an enormous amount of uncertainty in terms of how we can live together in this world, because there are so many different sort of streams of interest that for one reason or another are, you know, going to terrorism to try to make their points or express their pain or whatever it is. And it's never as clear as like they're just bad people and evil and need to be, you know, completely eliminated. You could argue that, in fact, we, to the U.S. to a large degree, sowed many of the seeds for the terrorism that is being reaped now by a misdiagnosis of 9/11, you know, 14 years ago.
So let me get to the practice of mindfulness per se around this, because, you know, when I was first learning mindfulness nearly 20 years ago, it was really focused on self and almost self exclusively. But, you know, its birthplace was with Buddha, who and Buddhism, who focused almost exclusively, I think, Jon, on the outside, on compassion for the larger world. So I want to understand how the practice, the everyday walking, talking practice of mindfulness could have an impact on the larger world.
Well, this is a very deep question. And, you know, I think that it's not clear that the Buddha simply focused on the outside. In order to generate compassion, one needs to, in some sense, open one's own heart. And very often, if you're speaking about self, we have a lot of ways in which our view of self is of ourselves is very limited and very, very, you might say, self-interested or self-centered. So to that degree, that can be a source of animosity, of violence, of ill will, and so forth. So the Buddha's teachings are not simply about inside and outside, but they're a profound expression, I think, probably the most profound in human history, of a non-dual wisdom that understands that the inside and outside are different aspects of the same one unity. And that would be true of the planet Earth and the sun and the universe and of the body itself and of our own individual bodies and the body politic, if you will, or what's going on globally, whether it's global warming or terrorism.
All right, so let's deconstruct that just for a minute. Give us an example of non-dualism when it comes, say, to self and other. What does that look like, feel like?
Well, what it would look like is that we wouldn't go to war anymore. It would look like, you know, I mean, there are many, many examples of how, you know, the Japanese who attacked Pearl Harbor and, you know, were like imperialist, like, you know, incredibly destructive, horrific stuff perpetrated in China and Southeast Asia and everywhere else, and like our deepest enemy, now they're good friends of ours. Do you know what I'm saying? Why did 40 million or 60 million people have to die, including us incinerating two cities? Of mostly innocent people. So here's where mindfulness comes in, or what you could call heartfulness, because, you know, some people make a distinction between mindfulness and compassion, but they are spoken of often as two wings of the same bird. So if you don't hear the word heartfulness when you're hearing the word mindfulness, you're not really understanding it, because in all Asian languages, the word for mind and the word for heart are the same word. So compassion is absolutely integrated into mindfulness, both in the practice and the cultivation and in the way we teach it.
All right, so let's just give us cliff notes here about this business of mindfulness and meditation. We know,
yes,
we know mindfulness is not sitting under a Bodhi tree for 7 years or clearing your mind or achieving bliss.
No. Exactly. And Mathieu Ricard is very strong on this point, the famous French monk who wrote this wonderful book on altruism and another on happiness. He says it's not like sitting under a mango tree to make yourself feel better. That what it is if you find some way to be fully who you are in this world through sitting down and being quiet and observing your own mind and befriending your own awareness, then that is healing and transformative and liberating in profound ways that maybe we'll have time to go into here, but I'm just going to assert it. And then once one, in some sense, befriends oneself, one sees that one is completely interconnected and inter-embedded with the rest of the world. And so it's not about more for me or selfishness. It's about actually understanding that who we think we are is nothing compared to who we actually are. And, you know, when we get self-centered, it's around this small narrative of who we are, what my interests are, my wants, my needs, my what I don't want, what I most fear. And that, you know, is a prescription for stress and suffering throughout life, because we'll never get to the place where, oh, now I can be happy, if we can't actually be happy in this moment with things exactly as they are, including the full catastrophe, if you will, of the human condition, to go back to Zorba the Greek's phrase.
And to go back to your international bestseller that's got to be 20 years old now.
Well, yeah, it's 25 years old and completely revised and updated 2 years ago. But you know, that's what meditation is really about. It's not simply inward quietude or anything like that. It's about fine-tuning your instrument so that you can actually be of some kind of greater use in the world for healing, for creativity, for helping others who are maybe not as fortunate, for contributing to a larger sort of flourishing, if you will, of the human species, and for that matter, life on this planet, not just human.
So
that does have political implications and economic implications immediately.
All right, let's go back to micro now. You know, what you're saying sounds great, but you don't get that when you read, say, your book, Full Catastrophe Living. When you're done reading that book in practice, you're not there.
No, I would not agree with you at all on that score.
Really?
I mean, we're good enough friends, so I can say that one of the chapters in there is on world stress, another is on food stress, another is on relationships. You know, it's all about transforming the world as you transform yourself. And in fact, if you're different, if you're a little bit less greedy or a little bit less frightened or a little bit less self-centered, the whole world is already in some small but not insignificant way also different, because you'll be different in your family, for instance, with your children or whatever.
Let me clarify my statement that, you know, what you're describing, we don't get there the first time we begin to sit and practice mindfulness.
I see. You mean it takes some time to develop this way of being.
And it takes a practice. So
yes.
Can you just tell us briefly the practice? Before you do, I want to reintroduce you. If my listeners are just tuning in, we're talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn, long considered the father, John, godfather, grandfather,
I don't get into those nuances. I don't make any claims at all.
You are considered that by
most.
Jon Kabat-Zinn, and of course he is that to mindfulness meditation. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. John's going to be with us for the first half of the show, so if you'd like to chat with him, please give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. So, John,
because we don't have much time, let me just cut to the chase, okay? Mindfulness is basically awareness. So you can listen and say, okay, mindfulness is awareness, I get it. And it's a kind of open-hearted, spacious quality of awareness, okay? So it's not thinking, but mindfulness is more powerful than thinking. It's not the antithesis of thinking. There's nothing wrong with thinking, except that it can drive us crazy. But if we can hold our thinking and our emotions in awareness, then we have more degrees of freedom in how to actually navigate our lives. So that's very freeing. And so the way you cultivate mindfulness is by seeing if you can inhabit awareness in this moment. And why this moment? Because it's the only moment we ever have is now.
So, for example, I might feel, or a listener might just be aware of how they feel in their body, what feels
exactly.
Good.
Exactly. Body's the best place to start.
And maybe the tone of your voice and or my voice, the contrast.
Exactly. And that we're in some kind of already, we're hearing what's here to be heard, okay? And it's not so much the objects of attention that we're featuring, it's the attending itself, and that's what we call awareness or mindfulness or heartfulness. And then we can learn to inhabit the space of our own awareness, and that gives us the ability to discern much more clearly and often more wisely what to do and what not to do, how to use our energy and how not to use our energy, how to listen deeply and then what to respond. And that can make a huge difference in your relationships with other people and, of course, with yourself. If, let's say, you're feeling pain or stress of one kind or another, never mind running to the doctor right away. How are you going to be in wise relationship to it? Or once you've seen all the doctors and there's nothing more that they can do for you. So this is like a huge opportunity. And as you so rightly say, it is a practice. It's something that one needs to cultivate in a kind of disciplined way on a regular basis. And of course, nobody wants to be too disciplined. And we're all very busy. So it takes time to do anything. So why would we possibly want to do this when all it is awareness and we're aware anyway? But if you start to pay attention, you'll begin very quickly realize that we're not aware of very much that unfolds at the level of the body or our thoughts.
Most of us are just aware of what we're thinking moment.
Yes, and also zoning along on autopilot. So a lot of time we're not even aware of what we're thinking. We're more prisoners of what we're thinking.
Yeah.
We believe our thoughts when they're not true, most of them. They're highly inaccurate.
Well, John, you know, the first time I met you, it was a live show here at WHYY.
I remember it well.
Do you remember the one of the openings when I compared the mind to a poorly functioning kidney? That you know, the kidney does its job very well. It figures out, you know, what we need and what's, you know. Excrement, but the mind doesn't. Like, all of our thoughts were, you know, that's real, that's valuable. And
right.
90% of that is waste matter.
Beautiful. You know, this is a profound insight. And another word for mindfulness would be insight meditation. It's actually seeing or discerning connections that really could be incredibly valuable in living life differently. Now, to come back to your original point, we need to do that at the level of geopolitics, because otherwise if you think of the planet as a whole, then it's like the, you know, you don't want the heart and the liver to go to war with each other, and then to get the kidneys at war with both of them and so forth. And when you have terrorism going on, it's like cancer. It's like cells that are like no longer have any sort of caring for the organism as a whole. They just want to eat up whatever it is that they want to eat up and take over. And that is a very, very toxic prescription for misery, for criminality, for enormous global suffering.
You know, John, I just want to say one thing before we go to the phones. My daughter was in trouble many years ago, having all sorts of difficulties, and her life was in danger. And she said to me, Dad, she said, I feel like I am a diamond inside of a malignant tumor, and I don't know what's going to happen here. And you know, me being a Westerner and a psychologist, you know, I was attacking that tumor, you know, all yes. sorts of interventions. But yes. you know what destroyed the tumor?
Was the diamond.
The diamond. It was nurturing the diamond.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's who she is today.
Oh, that's so beautiful, Dan, and I'm very happy to hear that, of course. And, you know, among your listeners, I'm sure there are, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people who have been through an MBSR program in the past whatever number of years and who will say very similar things. It's a discovery of a capacity that we all have that's innate to us that we never get any training in school,
yeah.
no exposure to.
Yeah.
Only now that's changing, and there are the schools, even primary and secondary schools, are training kids in mindfulness.
Ain't that grand. Listen, we've got a bunch of callers who want to join
sure,
the conversation. Let's start with Drew in Phoenixville. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Dr. Dan. Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say that I've gone through PTSD, and PTSD, it's always with you. It never goes away. And through mindfulness and meditation, that, for me, is the only thing that keeps it at bay. And I also have to say that it's not easy to do it. It's very difficult, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of practice.
I'm glad you said that last part. How, Drew, can you say or do you know how this practice keeps your PTSD symptoms at bay?
Oh, it's through empathy and forgiveness. Through my trauma, I just have to know that I have to forgive and to realize it is there. It's always going to be there. And to not let it destroy my life and destroy others, I have to learn to love. And to have, you know, you can't love others until you can learn to love yourself.
Go on.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry.
So, to you and John, you know, there we are again. We're talking about the diamond and
yeah.
the practice nurturing the diamond.
Exactly. And putting out the welcome mat, here's a beautiful point you make, is that, you know, that you say the PSD is always going to be there. So in a certain way, you're acknowledging that you don't have to fix anything or make anything go away or cut it out of you to be a whole human being. That's a part of you that you have to come to terms with in a certain way. And that's what I hear you say the meditation practice is doing for you. It's helping you to come to terms with this trauma and know how to be in wise relationship with you so that it doesn't eat up your life. And that's what I call wisdom. And you're right, it's also self-compassion.
Drew, thanks so much for your call. Let's go right to the phones, John. We've got Phyllis on the line. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi.
What can we do for
you? Thank you for having me. And I'm excited to hear that that this was a jewel of an accident coming. You know, coming back from my PT appointment to talk about this. I'm recovering from a concussion, and I took an 8-week program, a mindfulness program at Penn with Michael Baim and Scott
yes.
McBride.
I know
and,
Mike.
Yes, and I found that it was helpful at the time because I had headaches, and I feel that I've learned to use mindfulness to flush headaches at time, but you know, there's an emotional piece, and there's a, you know, listening to your last caller, Drew, talking about it's hard to practice, especially with concussion. you know, forgetfulness. It's very hard for me to put into practice, and but when I have been able to, my family had thought that I had, you know, seemed better. But I just wanted to know your view on the long-term help of mindfulness on concussion recovery.
Well, I'm going to pass that to John. I'm going to ask you to take your answer off the air because we are running low on time with John. John, is there any research about mindfulness and concussion that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, but that doesn't mean that that it couldn't be potentially very valuable, because there is a growing body of research on what's called mindfulness and neuroplasticity. And that is the brain's deep capacity that we all have throughout life to reshape itself depending on how we drive experience, depending on the kinds of experiences we develop. So just like your bicep will grow if you do certain kinds of exercises using weights to help it. You work with the resistance. In the same way, meditation may be difficult, but it's probably worth doing if you have, you know, traumatic brain injury. I know a lot of veterans and people with brain injuries are practicing in that way, and the military is studying this kind of thing at the moment. So I think that there's an enormous potential for mindfulness to actually reshape the brain in ways that optimize its functioning and reestablish its kind of baseline properties. And you know, that's new. The science of understanding how plastic not just the brain but even our genome is enormous. So there's enormous amount of hope here.
John, before you go, I want to talk about, you know, I introduced you as saying mindfulness was part of the fabric now these days. You know, when I first took the course, and I also took it with Michael Baim, it was called the Penn Program for Stress Management, yeah. And now it's called the Penn Program for Mindfulness, which really speaks to how much it's changed.
Yeah, the world has received it in a way that is truly extraordinary, and I think is proportional to the amount of pain and anguish that we're experiencing as a society and as a planet. That we know that, you know, looking for quick fixes from the outside only carries us so far, and to a certain degree, never really works unless it's complemented at least by the deep transformational work that is only ours to do and that we are deeply capable of as human beings. We're like born geniuses and miraculous beings with a deep capacity for flourishing, for health and well-being across the lifespan, and for dealing with the kinds of indignities and trauma of aging and death and difficulty. And that's the assignment of the moment for us, I believe.
So, John, we've got just 1 minute left. I want to ask you what you're working on besides I know you're working on being a grandfather, a biological grandfather.
Yes. Well, I guess since we have very little time, the only thing I'll mention is that, you know, I'm trying to support other groups who are doing this work in different venues in the world as best I can. And the one that, you know, is most recent is that the Parliament in the UK issued an all-party parliamentary report 2 weeks ago on mindfulness and its need for being supported in the UK in a much larger level for healthcare, education, criminal justice, and business. That's the Parliament of the United Kingdom, both House of Lords and House of Commons.
John, I got to tell you, that is just a beautiful note to end our discussion with, a note of hope for the big picture.
And well, great talk.
It was just wonderful. Again. John, you too.
I'm honored to be on your program.
I miss you, and yeah. we shall reconnect.
We need to talk offline.
Yeah, please take good care of you, John.
Big hug. And thank you all for listening.
That was John Kabat-Zinn. He's known as the founder of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program and the Center for Mindfulness at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. Coming up after just a 60-second break. We're going to be speaking with Kristen Neff. She's an associate professor at the University of Texas in Austin. She's also the author of Self-Compassion and co-creator of the 8-week Mindful Self-Compassion Program. All that and more right after this news from NPR. Whoops.
Caring Friends Home Care, a subsidiary of Friends Life Care Partners, supports WHYY, a nonprofit Quaker-based organization. Caring Friends Home Care provides in-home care services, including home care aides, meal preparation, dressing, hygiene, light housekeeping, and more. With hourly and live-in care, clients receive services while remaining in their own homes. Clients living in long-term care communities can receive additional support. Details at caringfriendshomecare.org.
Supporting WHYY, Yampolsky Law PC, a law firm based in Tree Rose, Pennsylvania, focused on transforming conflict through mindful practices of collaborative law, mediation, family law, and labor and employment law. More information at conflicttransformed.com.
Support for WHYY comes from T-Mobile, with a 4G LTE network designed for business. Learn more at T-Mobile.com/at work. That's T-Mobile.com/at work.
And we are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about mindfulness, and we're talking about self-compassion. Like I said before the break, we've got Kristen Neff on, and she's really on the forefront of the self-compassion movement. Kristen, welcome back to the show. It's good to be with you. Do we have you on the air? So we're having some...
You have me?
Yeah. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, that just calmed my anxiety down about 90%.
So, good, if you had a mindful moment there.
Yeah. Welcome back to the show. It's really good to be with you, Kristen.
Thank you so much.
So help us understand what it is and what it's not. You know, I don't know if you recall Al Franken doing Stuart Smiley on Saturday Night Live. You know, he's a dog, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, everybody likes me. So,
right.
You know, that was kind of a play with self-compassion. It's not that.
Sure. Well, actually, so one of the things I talk about with self-compassion, there's a lot of misconceptions about self-compassion that I think really prevent people from being kinder to themselves. One is there's a confusion with self-esteem, which is really what Stuart Smalley is talking about. Right. You know, judging yourself positively. You know, I'm good. I'm great. Actually, maybe I'm even special and above average, right? And the problem with self-esteem is precisely that you need to be special and above average to feel good about yourself. And it can lead to a lot of unhealthy processes of social comparison. Some people become narcissistic in their attempt to have high self-esteem, or they bully other people, or they're prejudiced against others in an effort to feel better about themselves. So self-compassion is not really judging yourself positively at all. It's just a matter of relating to yourself kindly. And it's especially relevant in those moments when self-esteem deserts you, and that's when you fail, you've humiliated yourself, you're really suffering in some way. Self-compassion can step in with kindness, care, and support, where self-esteem says, I'm a failure, you know, I'm no good, I hate myself. So really the research is pretty extensive now, showing that self-compassion is a much more stable source of self-worth than self-esteem, because it's not dependent or contingent on success the way self-esteem is.
Yeah, I often say at my lectures about self-esteem that esteem should never be for the self. It should be for other.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you can have unconditional esteem in the sense of all human beings, including ourselves,
right,
are worthy of being valued and cared for. Right. So that's kind of an assumption of self-compassion. But it doesn't matter whether or not we're successful in the moment or we failed in the moment. Right. It's kind of an unconditional worthiness that self-compassion taps into, that self-esteem tends not to.
Yeah. I want to back up with something you said, and I don't know if I would have challenged this before the attacks last Friday in Paris, uh-huh. but esteem yeah. for others, that's hard to do when you think of what happened in Paris.
Yes, it is. So the idea of compassion as opposed to esteem, right, is compassion doesn't judge self or others or good as bad, good or bad. And, of course, obviously what happened in Paris is horrific. It's horrible. It's terrible, right? And compassion recognizes it. But compassion, both for others and oneself, recognizes that at some level, we are all human beings. At some level, our actions and behaviors are shaped by millions of causes and conditions that are outside of our personal control. Our family, our culture, even our genes. I mean, did you choose a particular set of genes you have, right? So with compassion, the idea is we can accept, we can open our hearts to everyone, including ourselves, even in instances of wrongdoing. And what's remarkable is that doing so, say, you know, I'm more familiar with self-compassion. If you have compassion for your own mistakes, your own misdeeds, you're more able to take responsibility for what you've done and try to repair the actions because it's safe to own up, wow, I really blew it. I mean, it's, you know, it's so extreme in the case of Paris, it's almost hard to draw the parallels.
It,
but in
really
general,
is.
The principle of compassion allows us to be with and clearly see what has happened, you know, not to get lost in reactivity or avoid it because we can't think about it, it's too painful, to actually hold our seat in the midst of tremendous suffering, you know, regardless of the cause. And then compassion always has its eye on the prize. Compassion always wants the alleviation of suffering. Compassion is always aimed toward helping people suffer less. So whether that's others or the self, you know, the goal of compassion is always to reduce suffering. And in a way, the only way one can do that is by the wisdom of seeing how that picture is so much more complicated than we can see from our limited individual perspectives.
The, you know, the Dalai Lama is known to have said that, you know, all humans suffer, all humans one happiness. And you know what, Kristen? I'm good with that. You know, I believe it. I believe in compassion. This Paris thing, I'm going to need a couple days to wrap my, not just my mind, but my heart around that.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and by the way, you shouldn't, it's actually quite wise, your heart's response is not jumping straight to compassion for the terrorists. I mean, because really, I think especially in a case like this, I think the first person actually, in this case, for you to have compassion for is yourself, in the sense that your heart is overwhelmed with the anger, the frustration, the despair. I'm sure there's a lot of emotions going on. So your first goal is to turn toward yourself, to give yourself the strength and support and space to hold what you're feeling as it is, so, without trying to, you know, do a spiritual bypass and go straight to forgiveness,
yeah, right.
Or, you know, just really hold your own experience. And that will help you have the state of mind needed to take a larger perspective when the time is right.
So to go back to the Dalai Lama, you're very right to point out that in the wake of Paris, I suffer. All of us who bear
That's
witness,
right.
we suffer at the moment. Kristen, let me reintroduce you and give out the phone numbers. We're talking with Kristen Neff. She is the, I don't know about the founder, certainly the prime mover in the self-compassion movement. Our number is 888-477-9499. We are talking about self-compassion now and what that means. We'll be talking about some of the research. Again, 888-477-9499. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jenny? Hello? Jeannie? Do we have you? No. We lost Jeannie. I want to make another statement, though, about the Dalai Lama. It is reputed that he said people don't seem, on his first trip to the United States, he said people don't mm-hmm. seem to like themselves over there. He says, I don't mm-hmm. understand how this can happen when we all have a Buddha nature inside, like a piece of the divine. Any idea why mm-hmm. this critical judge that we all live with, why it's so prevalent, pervasive, and powerful in this country?
Yeah, well, and by the way, I think it is a universal phenomenon. It does vary by culture, but East Asian cultures, for instance, are incredibly self-critical. So it's not just an East-West thing. But I think I really like Paul Gilbert's work on this, understanding why we criticize ourselves in the first place, is when we perceive danger in the environment, our threat defense system gets triggered, and we go into fight, flight, or freeze mode. Now, the system evolves for physical threats to our body, our bodily cells, but the system is just as easily triggered to threats to our self-concept. So if we fail or we feel insulted or we feel humiliated in some way, we go straight into fight or flight mode to try to protect ourselves. The problem, of course, is the threat is to ourselves. The problem is ourselves. So we attack ourselves to try to fix the problem. And it turns into a very vicious circle of, you know, feeling bad about ourselves and being more reactive and feeling worse about ourselves. But really, I think if you really understand, you can have compassion for the process of self-criticism, because at some level, our brain is trying to keep ourselves safe. Okay, so what we're doing with self-compassion is we're using a different system to keep ourselves safe, and that's the caregiving system, that system that all mammals have that make think of a little kitten, you know, cuddle up, purring close to mommy, feel safe, feels protected. When we give ourselves warmth, even physical gestures of kindness, say kind, soothing things, say the things to ourselves that we'd say to a good friend, we also feel safe. And this form of safety is actually, in this mindset, we're much less reactive and we can be much more responsive, make wiser choices. So I think it's natural that the first instinct is self-criticism. We have to put a little more effort in to get to our other natural capacity, which is the capacity for compassion and care.
Well, before we have to take our break here, Kristen, I do want to point out that when we fail at something or when we feel shame, or, you know, what's happening is just what you pointed out with me in the wake of the Paris attacks. When we fail, we suffer, you know, if we have feelings
about
it. We are suffering, and unfortunately in this country, or in my experience professionally, that when we suffer, we don't even know we're suffering. And then we either act out or get depressed. You know, and if
that's why mindfulness is so key. As John said, mindfulness can't really be separated from compassion. We have to be aware of what's happening. Sometimes when I teach people how to be more self-compassionate, the very first thing I teach them to do is be aware when you're suffering. Just saying, wow, this is a moment of suffering. This is really hard. Even your description of your reaction to the Paris events, the acknowledgement, you know, saying to yourself, wow, this is really hard for me. All of a sudden, you're instead of being lost to the resistance about what happened, being lost in the despair and the frustration, you have a little more perspective, a little more spaciousness to see what's happening. What's happening is you're suffering. So you can have a couple reactions. I mean, I know you wouldn't do this because you're damned, but some people might just go straight into reactivity. Let's kill the bastards. Yeah. Let's bomb them. Right? You know, you laugh at it. That's a very common response.
Well, and that's
probably not going to be.
Yeah.
Is that your reaction?
Yeah. It's
probably a little more refined.
Well, it actually was. And I like to think of myself as nonviolent. But that was my reaction. Listen, let's take a short break, Kristen, and we'll come back. We've got a bunch of callers. That voice you've been listening to, is that? Belongs to Kristen Neff. She's an associate professor at University of Texas in Austin, the leader of the self-compassion movement. She's written a wonderful book, by the same name. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation distributes more than $1 million annually in scholarships to southeastern Pennsylvania students. Individuals, businesses, and educational institutions can set up a customized permanent scholarship fund through the foundation and receive tax benefits while helping students achieve their dreams. The foundation helps make it easy by taking care of paperwork and accounting. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Addiction can test a family's strength. When someone you love is struggling with addiction, you struggle too. Karen can help restore peace in your family. For more than 60 years, Karen has worked in the field of addiction treatment and behavioral health care, helping to restore the lives of thousands of patients and their families. Karen will help you take the next step. A confidential and no-obligation assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at caron.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, speaking with Kristen Neff about self-compassion. Kristen, let's go right to the phones. We've got Wendy on the line. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me to join the conversation.
Sure. So, what can we do for you?
I just wanted to add that I think we can look at very close to home to the situation of African Americans and the compassion that they have demonstrated towards the rest of the American community in spite of a fairly horrific past in trying to move forward through the civil rights movement and so forth.
Say more, Wendy. Sorry to sound like a therapist, but say more about the compassion and today's civil rights movement.
Well, I think that the emphasis on a spiritual life, particularly in the past in the African American community, allowed people to look past violence and the travails of the slavery period to be able to recreate themselves and to move forward.
That's certainly an interesting perspective. I really appreciate the call.
Can I say something to that,
sure,
Dan?
Yeah, I was just going to turn to you.
To say to Wendy, I mean, I love bringing up that point because often people think that compassion for self or others is a weakness. But actually, that's such a beautiful example, the civil rights movement, or look at Gandhi in India. Compassion can be an incredibly powerful force. Fierce compassion is the term used for it. So when fierce compassion is used, it's not like it allows harm to be continued, right? The civil rights movement said, line in the sand, this is not okay. But it didn't cut anyone out of the circle of compassion. It included even so-called enemies in the circle of compassion, which allowed things to heal so much more quickly. So, yes, you made a beautiful point. Compassion is an absolute strength for self and others that really deserves so much respect, I think.
Kristen, yeah. You use the phrase fierce compassion, and I know that's the language, but it sounds like an oxymoron.
It does, but it's not, right? So think of a compassionate mother. If her child's about to, get into danger, run into the street, or maybe eat, is left alone with an entire bag of Oreos, right? A mother says, no, clear line drawn in the sand. This is not okay. This behavior leads to harm. Compassion can be fiercely protective of oneself or others in the terms of trying to prevent harm. But the way it's done, instead of coming from a place of reactivity, of anger, of hate, which can often just cause more harm, right? The protective power of compassion is from this more responsive, wise, stable place, which actually helps responses that can make things more sustainable over the long run. But it's not weak or wimpy. Actually, compassion, I believe, and research would support this, is one of the most powerful sources of coping and resilience we have available to us.
So I want to put out here some questions or statements I get from people when I talk to them about self-compassion or teach.
Yeah.
So here, how can I have self-compassion when I've hurt people or lied to them? How can I have self-compassion when I'm so quick to anger? How can I have it when I'm lazy or a procrastinator or eat compulsively or on and on and on? How can I have compassion for that person?
Well, you know, what the research shows is that, in fact, self-compassion helps all of those conditions. So as I said, when you have more self-compassion, you're more able to take responsibility for what you've done because it's safe to acknowledge it, to own it. Wow. You need a lot of strength to say, wow, I really hurt you. If you're a habitual self-critic, you will, like, pull out every trick in the book to blame someone else. You aren't going to want to take responsibility. But if you have self-compassion, you're more likely to take responsibility for your actions. You're more likely to apologize and to try to repair things. With self-compassion, you're more motivated, not less motivated, to achieve your goals. People really think that self-criticism works as a motivator. It doesn't. When we beat ourselves up and say, oh, I'm a stupid, lazy failure, good for nothing, shameful, la, 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 you know, just the list goes on, we undermine our self-confidence, and we create a sense of fear of failing. The stakes are so high if we try and fail that usually we just give up and don't even try. Self-compassion, knowing that it's okay to try, it's okay to fail, allows people to keep trying and to persist even after failure. So again, you know, people just have a lot of misconceptions about compassion, what it is, what its effects are. So I also spend a lot of my time trying to clear those up.
Yeah, yeah, don't I know that. Let's go back to the phones, Kristen. We've got Rosemary on the line. Hi, Rosemary.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb, sorry. thank you so much for taking my call. I'm really enjoying the show. It's just so very, very interesting. And the reason I called was because I just wanted to share something, my own personal experience with regards to Paris, where Friday evening I was extremely upset. I went to bed. Saturday morning, in my morning prayers, I prayed for everyone, including the terrorist, because I just felt so strongly that we should hate the action but not the person. And I prayed that they would receive the graces or open their hearts to the graces that I feel that, you know, God, our Creator, is bestowing upon them. And what happened, I didn't plan on this happening, but it has helped me so much. Praying for everyone, including those who did these horrific acts, it just brought some kind of peace to me. And I didn't expect that, so just wanted to share that.
Thank you so much, Rosemary. You know, Kristen, there's actually research on that, on the impact of prayer, and it's very clear that those who pray, or any of the contemplative sciences, those who pray benefit from the action itself.
Yes, yes. Well, what you're doing is, one way I like to describe self-compassion, another way of describing it, is you're in a state of loving, connected presence. I actually talk about three components to compassion: kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. Loving, connected presence. So whether you pray, you meditate, or you're just practicing being kind to yourself, when you are in a state of loving, connected presence, even in the midst of horrific suffering, even in the midst of having to grapple with the horror of what happened in Paris, first of all, your mind state is calmer and more peaceful and more loving. And everyone you come into contact with, instead of contacting hatred, instead of contacting, you know, overwhelm, they're contacting loving, connected presence, and they benefit from that directly as well. So, I think spirituality and Christianity and Buddhism and all these traditions are onto something here.
So let me ask you
and science.
let me ask you something. You're one pretty busy human. I mean, I look at your web page and you're, you know, all over the world doing all sorts of interesting and wonderful things. So, tell me how you practice self-compassion.
Well, you know, it has to be intentional because, I mean, yeah, I get lots of offers to go places, and at first I just wanted to say yes to everything, but I also have other important things in my life. My son is very important to me, so really just trying to find a balance between how much I can be away, how much I can take on, and still have time for my family, my relationships, and myself. I feel like I'm finally getting better at it, but... But it's not easy. But really just putting a lot of value on work-life balance and value on, again, what the conditions of my life need to be in order for me to maintain the state of loving, connected presence moment by moment as I go through my days. It's been a challenge.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you got to work at it. Yes, I'm sure you know.
Yeah, Kristen, I went, you know, many years ago we did a show on work-life balance. And my guest said... there is no such thing. You know, it's like the seesaw thing, you know, when you're perfectly back, like how long does that last, you know? So, it's always a back and forth. And if we're lucky, we learn from that. Kristen, I've got bad news for you and me and our listeners. We are out of time, and I'm really sorry about that. I always, always enjoy spending time with you on the radio.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan.
Bye-bye. Kristen Neff is the leader of the self-compassion movement. Earlier on, we heard from Jon Kabat-Zinn, founder of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, many, many years ago. I got a program note here. Next week's the end of our weekly show and an open show for you to call in, but I am not going anywhere. You'll still hear my monthly chats with Mike and Scott, and we're busy at work on our bi-monthly specials, which will give you a chance to be part of the event in the community. Actually, we've got one. We're all set up for airing in January. I think it's the second week in January. Well, follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. I'll be making weekly posts there at the very least. And please check out my webpage at drdangottlieb.com. We've always got new entries there also. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Diana Martinez. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Trin Thatch is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family, par excellence, by the way. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.